it's a pleasure to be here, and it's very exciting to see a room so full of people who have nothing else to do on Rosh Chodesh but come and learn Torah. I'd like to begin with source number one on your source sheet. The sheet begins with the Nes Gadol Hayapo. It's at the end of the source booklet. Actually, we're going to skip the first source and begin with the source, the paragraph number one next to it. It's the Gemara in Shabbat. The pages do not have numbers. It looks like this. And it has a number one next to it. You don't even have to look at the source because it's a Gemara that you all know. The Gemara in Shabbat is basically the source for Hanukkah. Kishenechnesu ha-Yevanim la-Hechal, when the Yevanim entered the Hechal, timu kol hashmanim shebehechal. They made impure all of the oil that was in the Hechal. U'kishegavra malchut beit hashmonai v'nitzcham, and when the Hashmonaim were finally victorious, badku v'lo matzu elapach echad shel shemen. They looked and they were only able to find one small vial of oil shehaya munach b'chotmo shel kohen gadol. It still had the seal of the kohen gadol on it. V'lo haya bo ela l'hadlik yom echad. But they only had enough oil to last for one day. Nasebo nes, but a miracle was done. Vedliku imenu shmoni yamim. But instead it ended up lasting for 8 days. L'shana acheret kav'um v'asu'am yamim tovem b'halel u'b'hoda'a. And after that miracle of the pach shemen, of the vial of oil, that after that we had the Chag of Chanukah. Now, I understand why God needed to make a miracle for the Jews to win the war. But why was there a need to make the miracle of the oil? Why did God need to make that miracle? If somebody, God forbid, doesn't have hands, God doesn't expect them to wear tefillin. If you don't have oil, so you don't light the menorah. Like, why is it that God had to change nature in order to allow this miracle to occur? This is not something that demands a miracle. And in order to understand this, I think we need to dig deeper into what exactly is the miracle of the oil and what exactly is shemen. Shemen, the Hebrew word for oil, always represents chokhmah. Shemen always represents knowledge. And I think you can understand why. The whole concept of light, the whole concept of spreading light, the whole concept of somebody who is not knowledgeable is said to be in the dark. Okay, so this is a metaphor that we're all familiar with, so that the concept of the shemen and the light comes together with wisdom. And if we take a look at source number 5 on that very same page, well, actually, let me just prove this to you first. Let's go back to source 2, 3, and 4. Source 2 is the Gemara in Baba Batra. There the Gemara tells us, Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, Harotzeh Sheyachkim Yadrim. If you want to become smart, then go to the south, which is, what's the south? The south is where the menorah stood, because that, again, is the source of light. If you look at source number 3, it's the pasuk in Shmuel, Vayishlach Yoav Tekoa. Yoav went to Tekoa, and what was he looking there? Vayikach misham isha chachama. And he took from there a wise woman. Now, why did he specifically go to Tekoa to find the wise woman? And that we have in source number 4. Vayishlach Yoav Tekoa, Vayikach misham isha chachama. Ma ishana Tekoa. Why did he specifically go to Tekoa? Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan teaches, Mitoch Sherigilim b'shemen zayit. How did they make their living in Tekoa? What was the source of their income? Oil. And again, we have that connection of the oil and the wisdom. Chachma mitzuya bahem. We have chachma there. We also know that there's this idea that they had enough oil to last one day. So that the miracle was really not 8 days, but the miracle was really seven. This is a very famous Talmudic concept. I've seen books this thick discussing this question, and we're going to come back and give an answer to it later on once we finally understand what indeed is this oil and what it represents. Taking it a little bit further, let's now look at that Kuzari, which is source number five. The Kuzari writes, Ha'eloha l'dat ha'philosophim. He says, the philosophical approach to God is me'al yidi'at ha'pratim. In other words, they believe that God exists. What they don't believe in, nimsa she'ein Eloha makir otcha. God exists, but he cannot be involved in your everyday life, what we would call the denial of hashkacha pratit. So they believe in God, but he's too eminent, he's too far away, he's too busy, so to speak, to be involved in what happens in your everyday life. Now, what does this mean in terms of ramifications? If you believe in God, but you believe that he can't be involved in your everyday life, first of all, it means he also doesn't know what you're thinking and what you're doing, which means that, what does it mean? Think about the ramifications. He doesn't hear your prayers. There is no concept of reward and punishment. He cannot make miracles because he's not involved. So all of these things, it takes God out of your everyday life. He exists, but he's too far away. And this, according to the Kuzari, was the approach of what he calls the philosophers. But if we look at source six, we'll see which philosophers we're really talking about. The outlook of the Greek thinkers was in opposition to the teaching of Torah. We're talking specifically about the Greeks. The Greek position is that the world always existed, and God did not create the universe from absolute nothingness. God did not create Yesh Me'ayin. And he has no ability to change anything in the world because the world came before him. Because he cannot, since he didn't create it, he can't change it. According to them, the world was, is, and always will be, for it always existed and is not susceptible to change. From this, we derive another principle of the Greeks. Turn the page. That the forces of nature rule the world. All circumstances and events throughout a person's life are not in compensation for any good or bad action, because God can't see reward and punishment. Rather, they are consequences of total random acts of nature. And I think this is something we understand, that the battle between the Jews and the Greeks was not only one about physical survival, but it was one about spirituality and wick and specifically functioning about how do we view God and what relationship God has with his creations. And so the whole idea of the Pach Shemen, which represents Chochmah, we have one Pach that's left with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. We're saying that this idea runs against completely what the Greeks stand for. The Greeks said God can't do miracles. He can't interfere with nature. So therefore, we're saying on Hanukkah that don't be fooled. This is something you should also be familiar with. Source number seven. Source number seven is based on the Midrash when Avram Avinu at the Brit Bein HaBetarim, he falls into a deep sleep and a darkness falls upon him. And there the Pasuk says, V'choshech ze galut Yavan. Yavan personifies darkness. And it's interesting because we look at Greeks as being the cultured, right? The ones who were enlightened, right? That's what the Greeks are here. And here the Metrist is telling you, don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by that. Because what is really Greek? Greeks are darkness. And we'll see, and our job is to bring the light back into the world. And if we look at source number eight, is Eliyahu Kitov in the Sefer Toda'ah. And he says, as we've been saying, wherever the Torah or sages refer to the oil used to light the menorah, an allusion is intended to the wisdom of the heart and the thoughts of the mind. Oil, wisdom. When the Greeks entered the Holy Temple and defied the oil, they blemished the thoughts and the feelings of the majority of the people of Israel, who began to accept the wisdom of the Greeks contained enduring reality. When the Hashmonaim came and entered the sanctuary, they found one jar that contained pure oil, an amount sufficient for one day's lighting. Despite all that the Greeks had done to defile the thoughts and the people of Israel, there still remained a modicum of light in their hearts, a single spark of true wisdom, which enabled them to know that they were sacred and had been chosen among the nations. The nations of the world were destined to follow Israel's light rather than Israel following them. So the issue, again, is a philosophical argument. There is a little bit of undefiled oil. We would say that, I think, what today I think we would call that the Pintaliyid. Right? That no matter, and I think the Lubavitchers have taken this to the extreme, that the idea of no matter how far a Jew has gone, no matter how, you know, whatever they're involved in, there's still that little flask of oil. There's still that little spark in them that can be brought out. And so that's the symbolism here of Hanukkah. Now, what we're going to see today is this is actually not the first miracle of the oil. There was actually a miracle of the oil that preceded the story of the Hashmonaim, because everything is in Torah. It's all there. We just have to find it. So I'd like you to please turn back to the first page of the source, and you have a very short story. It's only 121 words that appears in Melachim Perek Dalid, from Pasuk Aleph to Zion. Now, we are running a little bit late, so we're going to cut the Chavruta time down. But what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to ask you just to read the verses. For those of you who want, you'll notice that there are questions on top that you might want to think about while you're reading the story. And then we will see, obviously, what is the connection between our two miracles of the oil. If anybody needs help locating the source of notes, are you interrupted?
Thank you.
Okay, our story begins with an individual problem. We have, this is not a national issue. This is a very private issue, as opposed to the Hanukkah story. And it seems to be a very simple story. There's a woman with a problem, and the Navi solves it using a flask of oil. Now, the Navi at this point in time is Elisha. Elisha, we're talking about 850 BCE, about that time, and we know this from archaeological data. Remember that he is the prime student of Eliyahu, and there are plenty of different ways that Eliyahu could have helped this woman, Elisha, could have helped this woman without using the miracle. Why does Elisha feel a need to make this miracle? Notice that the story is told to us not by a narrator, but rather through the mouths of the people. And our woman, what do we know about her? We know that her husband, and we'll come back to this, is one of the B'nai HaNevi'im. He is one of the sons, he was part of the Navi crowd. And she calls out to Elisha, and she says to him, Avtecha ishi meit, I am a widow. My husband is dead, and you know that my husband was a God-fearing man, and the nosheba, the creditor, is coming, and he wants to take my two children as slaves because I cannot pay back the creditor. Now, this is a common occurrence of calling out to an authority figure when you have trouble. I don't know if you just take a quick look at source 9, 10, 11, and 12. Those are other examples where you have the Isha HaTekoit calls out to the king and says, oh, king, save me. Okay, the Navi is coming in source number 10, and he too calls out to the king, oh, save me. So the question here we have to ask is then, if the common occurrence is to call out to the king, if this is an accepted form, and apparently, by the way, the king used to come out on the rampants or onto the, and the people who had trouble would say to him, oh, king, save me. And so usually this is when there was an injustice, and you turn to the king in order to provide justice. So the obvious question here is why does our woman call out to Elisha when if she feels that there's an injustice, she should be calling out to the king? So there's a very good possibility, and that's probably the truth, is that in this situation, it is actually the king who is the creditor. Now, the king here, the creditor here does not have a name, but apparently the king here is Yehoram ben Ahab. Yehoram ben Ahab was not known to be a very virtuous human being, as his father was not, and he lent money to this woman's husband. Husband died. She can't pay him back. We're going to take your children as collateral. So she turns to the Navi, hoping that the Navi will help her. He is a Navi who helps the downtrodden. So why doesn't he go out and fight against the king? Why does he only help this one specific woman? He only helps this one specific woman because this is, by the way, the approach of Elisha. Eliyahu was the fire and brimstones. He was, let's change the world. Elisha was not interested in changing the world. Elisha was interested in helping one individual. And his attitude was, if you help this one individual, you've also changed the world. And so he is going to help this woman. Now, why is Elisha going to help this woman? What kind of relationship does he have to her? Who was her husband? Now, there's a concept in learning Tanakh, which is called the conservation of personalities, which means that we have a personality who doesn't have a name. Chazal tried to find some sort of connection to somebody who has a name and figure out who this person is. So you will notice that this husband of hers is described as a God-fearer. Now, there are only four other people in Tanakh who are called God-fearing. Those four people are Abraham, Eov, Ovadia, and I'll get the fourth one in a second. Avram, Yosef, Eov, and Ovadia. Now, the only one who would be correct in terms of the time period is Ovadia. Now, let's take a look here, and we'll see in source number 18. In source 18, it tells a story that there's a terrible famine in the land. The famine is so bad that Achav, the king himself, has to go out looking for food. And he brings his right-hand man with him. And who is his right-hand man? Vayikra Achav el Ovadia asher al habayit. He calls over the guy who's head of staff, chief of staff. His name is Ovadia. And here the pasuk says, V'hu yarei et Hashem. He is described as somebody who fears God. This woman's husband is described as somebody who fears God. So therefore, Chazal connect the two. Now, what do we know about this Ovadia? In the next pasuk, it tells us, "Vayhi b'hichris Izevel et nevi'ei Hashem." Izevel, source number 18, Izevel, the wife of Ahav, went on a pogrom against the nevi'ei Hashem because she wanted to bring in the nevi'ei Habal. Remember, this is a year of famine. What does Ovadia do? "Vayikach Ovadia mea nevi'im vayach be'em hamishim ish b'me'ara v'kilkalem lechem v'mayim." Ovadia takes 100 prophets, separates them 50 and 50, and feeds them during this time of famine. Famine, there's very little food, and whatever food there is really expensive. So probably in order to feed this Nevi'im, Ovadia had to borrow money. Who does he borrow money from? The king, who he happens to be chief of staff. Now Ovadia is dead. The widow is left with the debt that he accumulated because he was feeding the Nevi'im. So it makes sense that she turns to Elisha and says, you have to help me because this whole thing came out because of the debt that we incurred when we saved the Nevi'im. And Elisha feels a need to indeed save her, because if he doesn't save her, then we have an example of tzaddik v'ralo. There's no such thing as a tzaddik that his children do not have what to eat. So she turns to the father of Nevi'im, right? Her son, her husband is B'nai Nevi'im, and she asks him to help her. Now, if you want to just see this in source number 19, that's the Rashi where he follows through that this wife is the widow of Ovadia. So she turns to Ovadia, and she says, Elisha says to her in pasuk bet, "Ma e'eseh lach? What should I do for you?" Now, this is a biblical phrase that is used specifically when one person owes something to another. It's not just "What do I want you to give me?" It actually shows that the speaker feels that I owe you something. And you have this in source number 15. There's another example when Eliyahu is about to die. And he says to Elisha, "Ma e'eseh lach? What should I do for you?" Or, for instance, in 17, at the end of this, in the same parak that we're in now, when he's by the Shunammite who has hosted him all of this time, his question is, "Me la'asot la? what should we do for her? Which indicates to us already at the beginning of Pasuk Bet that Elisha feels a responsibility to help. He does feel that there is a need to help her. And he says to her, what do you have in the house? And at first, her first reaction is, nothing. I have nothing. And then she remembers, wait, I do have an asich shemen. Now, the only time this term asich shemen appears is in this story. Now, many those of us who cook, we think, think of oil. It's not. An asich shemen is probably, you might have seen it in the museum, it's that little cod that they used to use, and they used to put makeup from the shemen. So it's a little, picture a little jar, literally, a little jar that you would have a little bit of oil in that they would use for, to make their skin smooth. And this is what she has in the house. Now, why is it important for Elisha that he does the miracle based on something that he has in the house? So that's an important point. But the first thing the Navi is telling her is her response is, I have nothing. And the Navi wants to say to her, as long as you have something in your house, we can work with that. It doesn't need quantity, you just have to have a certain quality. Now, miracles, we know, disturb the natural rules of nature, the natural rules of the order. And we even know that even when God wants to do a miracle, he always tries to do this miracle within the framework of nature. God does not like to change nature. And let's look at Source 20. Source 20 begins at the end of the page, but continues on the next page. It's the Gemara in Shabbat. And it's a story that many of you are familiar with. The rabbis taught, it once happened that a man's wife died and left a child to be suckled, and he could not afford to pay a wet nurse. Whereupon a miracle was performed for him, and his teats opened like the two teats of a woman, and he suckled his son. Rabbi Yosef observed, come and see how great was this man, that such a miracle was performed on his account. Said Abaya to him, on the contrary, how lowly was this man that the order of creation was changed on his account. So you see already here that there's this conflicting opinion of how do we look at a miracle. Is a miracle a great thing, or is a miracle an actually a problematic thing because it's changing the rules of nature? Remember, the Greek said that God could not change nature. Let's remember that. But even as Elisha does perform a miracle, he limits the miracle. So how does he limit the miracle? The first thing he does is only God creates what we call yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. Only God could do that. So in order for Elisha to do the nes, he has to connect it to something. So therefore he asks her, where is that oil in, what do you have in your house? How else does Elisha limit this miracle? The miracle is limited. It's limited in time. It's limited in place. It's also limited in who is going to see the miracle. It's kept quite private. The place, the time, all of that is limited. Now, it's interesting to note that Elisha is actually performing this miracle when he is not even there. Notice that. But let's take a quick peek in the Ramban, which is source number 23. In source number 23, the Ramban explains, Ki brachat Hashem me'et hayot ha'alam lo nivra yesh me'ayin. When God created the world, he created it ex nihilo. He created something from nothing, only God. Aval olam kiminhag noheg. life that we live follows a certain pattern. Vayar Elohim et kol asher asa v'hineh tov ma'od. God created the world and it was good. Aval kasher yesh sham shoresh davar. But if there's already a root of something, tochol alav habracha, then the blessing can fall on it and tosif bo. And then you can add. But there has to be that initial something for the bracha to fall on. And the Ramban in Breishit brings our story. Kasher amar Elisha. Just like Elisha said, Hagidali li ma yesh babayit. Tell me what you have in the house. V'chala habracha al asich hashemen. And then his blessing fell on that little flask of oil. Umal'ak kol hakelim. And then it filled all the other vessels. Now this, because of this, by the way, we have a number of halachot. For instance, the halacha of leaving bread on the table for benching comes from this idea that the bracha has to come onto something. The idea of birkat kohanim is also connected to this. Why do I need the kohen to bless me? God can bless me. But the idea is that there should be something tangible for the bracha to flow through. And just to see this, and we have that on source number 24, the Tosefta tells us, Ein bracha shura ela b'maseh yadav shel adam. Man, and we're familiar with this from many stories, man has to take the first step. He has to put in some effort in order to receive that bracha. And so we understand why he specifically needs something in the house. Then he tells her to go collect pots. Why does she have to go collect the pots? Why does she have to collect those pots? Why does she need the vessels? Use them. To hold the oil. Why does she need more? Why does he tell her, go out? See, very clearly he tells her, go out and collect the vessels from your neighbors. Okay, so this is what Rav Ariel says. Rav Ariel says exactly that. That for a woman, a family, to reach that level of poverty, that they have nothing in the house except for a tiny little jar of oil makeup, indicates that there's also a problem in the society. And that by going to ask the neighbors, she'll be including them in her problem, or perhaps they're not even aware of it, and that it no longer becomes just her issue, but it becomes a more public one. It's also part of this idea that man needs to be active because God only helps those who help themselves. But now Rabbi Samet points out, look carefully in source 3 and 4, verse 3 and 4, compared to verse 5. In verse 3, the Navi tells her, right, Sha'ali lach kelim. Go out and get those vessels. What does she do in verse 5? No. She comes in and closes the door. What did she not do? She does not collect the vessels. He tells her, go get the vessels, and she goes home and closes the door. She skipped the step of getting the vessels. Why? Why would she skip that step? They bring it to her from her house. Those are the ones that are in her house. Why doesn't she go to the neighbors like the Navi? The Navi told you to! Right. One could very possibly be that she's embarrassed. Again, it says, the Navi says to her in verse 2, she says, what's wrong? And in verse 3, he says, go out and get vessels from your neighbors. Then come home and close the door. See, that's verse 3 and verse 4. In verse 5, it just says, and she went and closed the door. That collecting the vessels is missing. So it's very possible that she doesn't collect the vessels because she's embarrassed. That's correct. Well, no, the sons bring her from her own house. We'll talk about that in a moment. Why else, perhaps, does she not go to collect from the neighbors? So it could be that in the past she already knows that help from them she's not going to get. It could be she doesn't trust them, right? They're going to say to her, what do you need those pots for? And she's not quite sure how she's going to answer that question. It could be also that she didn't understand the magnitude of the miracle that the Navi was going to do. That perhaps here she was also lacking a little bit of trust in the Navi. And, or it could be just her excitement already. She wants to do it. So she comes home, and what happens? She, in the house, verse 5, she's there with her and her children. They, the sons, bring her the pots, and she is pouring from this little pach shemen, and it's not being empty. But all of a sudden, verse 6, there are no more pots, and she says to her son, bring me more pots, and he says to her, we don't have any more. That's it. And then, vayamod hashemen, there is no more oil left in the pots. Now, first of all, before we go any further, why does she have to close the door? Why can't anybody see it? Right, obviously the door is because they have to keep it private. Okay, and so if what happens if the people realize there's some sort of nace? They will bring their jugs over, perhaps. And this is something I think that we are familiar with, right? The whole concept of, and the Abarbanel says this, that there should be no ayin hara on it, that nobody should look and say, how come her and how come not me? The Malbim says that if somebody unworthy would see it, it would cause harm to it. And I think more importantly, something that we are all familiar with in source number 25, the Gemara in Baba Batra says, Ein habracha mutsuya ela b'davar hasuma min ha'ayin. If you want a blessing to fall on it, it has to be hidden. Nothing good ever comes out from something that everybody knows about. It's much better to keep it private, and he wants to keep it private. So once she's collected all of these, once she has filled all of these vessels, she turns to the sons and says, bring me more, and they say, there are none. And then, look, I don't know if many of you saw this, if you turn to this page, there's one more verse. There's one more verse. Verse 7, and you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, why do I, Vatavo Vatageid Le'ish Elohim. Now she comes and reports back to the Navi, and he says to her, go sell the shemen, pay back the creditor, and you and your sons can live with the remainder. Now, why does she need to go back to the Navi? Obviously, the Navi knows what happened. He made the miracle. Is she thanking him? She doesn't seem to be thanking him. So one thing is she doesn't know what to do with it. This has now become holy oil. So she wants to know, can she sell it? Does she have to take shumos and maestros from it? I mean, there are a whole bunch of questions that come out, and she wants to know what to do with it. It could be also that she's sort of maybe asking for a second chance. Right? He had told her, go borrow from the neighbors. She didn't. So now she's coming back to the Navi, and she's saying to him, well, and he's saying to her, no, you don't need it. It could also be very practically that she's waiting to ask the Navi, should I sell the stock or should I hold on to it? What's the market value of the shemen now? Maybe if I wait 3 days, maybe that, and that, by the way, you could have asked that could have been the miracle. Why did he have to make the miracle of the oil? God could have made that tomorrow oil is worth $10 billion, and all you need is a tiny little thing, and you make $10 billion. Why did God have to change nature in order to make this miracle? And by the way, so the answer that the Navi gives is yes, sell the oil, pay back the creditors, and anything that's left, you can live off of it, you and your sons. Now let's talk about the symbolism here, okay? She was supposed to take vessels from outside, and her sons are bringing them inside. She's then supposed to close the door, and the oil from the little pach is what's filling up these outside vessels. The message here that the Navi, I think, is giving us, the readers, is that there are many vessels in the world around us. The culture that we live in is vessels. We are allowed to bring those vessels into our home, but we have to be careful that we fill them with our oil. We fill them with our shemen. What was she so afraid of that the king was going to take her children? She was so afraid of this because she and her husband were raising the children to be God-fearing. She's afraid that if they leave her home and they go to the home of Yehoram ben Ahav, who is going to be filling their vessels? Izebel. I tell you, right? Not him. Not them. And that is why she's coming to Elisha. It's not a matter of just physically saving her children. She's actually looking for a spiritual saving of her children. She said, you can't put them into that environment. In order for them to succeed, they have to stay within the confines of my environment. And that's why she has to close the door. And that's why it's the sons who are bringing her the vessels that she is constantly pouring into the vessels that they are bringing to her. There is what to gain from the Greeks. There is culture in the Greeks. The question is, what's the vessel and what do we fill it with? What becomes the ikar and what becomes the tafel? Now, from this story, we learn, first of all, a tremendous amount about miracles. We learn that miracles have to have something to take from. We learn that you have to be part of the miracle process. We learn that it has to be private. We learn that it has to be limited, place and time. We understand that how you use those things that were affected to miracles. You'll notice, though, that our story begins abruptly, and does she sell the oil? Does she live happily ever after? We don't know. Notice that. We assume that she does, but notice that we don't hear what happens. But I think that it's obvious to everybody sitting here that there has to be a direct connection between this story and the Hanukkah story. Both the stories are based on a little flask of oil that doesn't run out. So first of all, this could be the answer to that question. Why is it 8 days and not seven? So if you turn now to Rav Yosef Karo, here on the last page of the source booklet, on page 21. Excuse me, source 21. Source 21. Another explanation is that after they poured the required amount of oil from the flax into the lamp of the menorah, the flask remained as full of oil as it had originally been, and the miracle was obvious even on the first night. Where does he get this from? Rav Yosef Karo is obviously basing that miracle on this miracle with Elisha. Just the way here, the flask didn't empty out, therefore it didn't empty out in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore the miracle was indeed 8 days because it was already filled up there. The miracle in our story seems to be of a smaller nature. It seems to be more private because it's just one idea. The miracle of the oil, this also helps us explain, you've all heard this idea. We all celebrate the miracle of the oil of Hanukkah, and that's what I read you, the Gemara. What is missing from that Gemara? What don't we have? And you all know this about Hanukkah, that we do not celebrate the war. We do not celebrate the military victory. And now you all understand why. First of all, the military victory, you could say that that's nature. Sometimes guerrillas do succeed. It happens. Sometimes, you know, something happens. Whatever. So you could explain away the war as being something natural. But the Pach Shemen, that is something that there's no other way to explain it. And as I pointed out to you, there was no need for God to do that miracle. So what we're beginning to understand is the Hanukkah story using Elisha and our widow as a background is giving us perhaps a new perspective on Hanukkah. The root of the word Hanukkah is chinuch. It's chinuch, which means education. And we're learning something important about education. The outside world is dangerous. I didn't hear the other shiurim, but I understand you talked about the concept and why it's so important that it be ish u beto. You understand the importance of the house. I said, I didn't hear the shiur, but I can imagine that they're essentially saying the same thing, that when you close your house, the pots can come from outside. The ideas can come from outside, but you have to fill them with that which is inside. And the Navi tells her, she thinks she doesn't have anything. And the Navi is building her self-confidence. And he's telling her, yes, there has to be something there. They want to kidnap the children. The Greeks want to. They don't want to kill us physically. They want to change our culture. And that's the idea that we as parents and grandparents have to have an overflow in order to fill our children and our grandchildren's vessels with what's from inside and not outside. And we have this very strongly in source number 22. Rabbi Shimon Pinchas says about Hanukkah, why is it that only those generations saw miracles, but we in our day do not see miracles occurring? Why is it only the generation of the desert or the Hashmonaim that merited witnessing divine miracles while we do not possess this merit? God governs the world through a system of nature and also by actual miracles. Miracles occur around us daily, and yet people are not affected, nor do they realize what is happening around them. Just as certain sound waves exist in the world's atmosphere, but can only be detected by special instruments, likewise, God provides man with plenty of miracles, even in our times. And I think those of us who live in Israel understand this in ways that perhaps others don't. But our challenge and task is to open our eyes and ears to all that is happening around us, and it comes to reinterpreting and understanding what are the messages. Now, besides chokmah being compared to oil, there's something else that is compared to oil. What else is compared to oil? Somebody said it? The Jews. The Jews are compared to oil. Why? Right, so that's an answer that you hear. That's an answer that you hear. It's not such a pleasant answer, but there is an answer that how do you get pure olive oil? The way you get pure olives is by squeezing them. This is the answer of Rabbi Yochanan. He says that that's what happens, that the Yisurim that Jews go through is part of that purification process. That is one answer. There is another answer, which is said by Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, is Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi says, oil does not mix with water. And that when you put them together, no matter what happens, the oil will come on top. And the idea is, and by the way, we keep talking about Shemen, representing oil, representing wisdom, representing that which we as parents are overflowing to our children. If you take the word HaShemen and you rearrange the letters, you get Neshama. you get the neshama, which is the uniqueness, and that's the idea of Hanukkah, of educating that you don't have to close out the entire world around us, but bring it in, and we have to control it rather than letting it control us.